to bear with unbearable sorrow. Run where the brave dare not go. Right the unrightable law. To love or insist from afar. To try when your arms are too weary. To reach the unreachable star. You might win. Oh, but far, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right. Without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the world will be better for this. Not one man scorned and covered with scars, still died with his last ounce of courage. To be the unreachable.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak. I want to welcome you to Progressive News Network. Thank you for joining us. Today, we're going to be talking with Representative Mark Pafford. And I also want to talk to you a little bit about some of the things going on. I always want to remind you also that in addition to Progressive News Network, there are many other fine progressive activists in Florida doing the good work, getting the truth out, talking to activists, talking to thought leaders, and getting the news to you. And let me mention just a few. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy. Miss Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Also our friend Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women Media. Our friend Susan Nylon and her show, The Nylon Show. And, of course, Sita Bigwheel, Sita Media. And also our fine friend, The Voice, Harriet Lerman, who does her good work, too, The Voice of the People. Okay. We've got an interesting time going on right now, of course. Commercial news is all full of, if it's not Benghazi, it's some other pseudo-scandal. And, of course, the important news here in Florida is our gubernatorial race for governor. And we've got a great progressive activist running. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, let me bring on our great Florida progressive activist and legislator, Mr. Pafford, sir. Welcome.
Hi there, and I'm unmuted, I promise.
Okay, great. Good start.
And this is the first time I'm doing very well. This is one of the first times I'm actually using a landline, so I'm hoping throughout the entire interview we have a really good connection, and if all else fails, I've built a fire so we can have smoke signals.
Okay, that's great. And the carrier pigeon should be there any minute.
Absolutely.
We at least have a chance to talk because, of course, the full weight of the end of net neutrality hasn't hit us yet, but that's a story for another time. Sir, I want to thank you for the wonderful work you've done in this legislative session, and I want you to kind of give us your overview, sir, on the good, the bad, and the ugly of this past legislative session.
I am available. Fire away.
First things first, if you were to say, many people believe that even though Democrats are in the minority, we have a stronger hand. We've had a stronger hand this year than we've had in the past for some time. Would you say that's a true assessment, sir?
Repeat that one more time. I want to make sure I understood
what I
that.
Said was Democrats, even though we're still in the minority in the legislature, mm-hmm. we've had a stronger hand, and we've been able to fight back more effectively and make a little more forward progress. Is that the way you see it?
You know, I mean, certainly I think the optics of the situation would appear that way this year. However, you know, I would differ a little bit. I think, you know, we are really outnumbered heavily, both in the House and the Senate, and certainly the governor has shown no interest in some of the basic things that, you know, as far as the Democratic members, our side of things, you know, hold any special interest or priority for him. I think if there were any advantages this year, it would be that, you know, you have a governor who basically does not have a Republican primary, nor does he have, you know, a Tea Party type of agenda because of that. And so he's been able to dive a little bit to the middle to basically help his reelection campaign in November. And so, you know, I think the optics may suggest what you say, but I think the reality is actually motivated. It's rooted in something else. And, you know, we can get into some of the details, but I'll stop there and keep asking.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You know, there has been a lot of grassroots energy and concern about our many and various water quality issues. And as we saw, the legislature was prepared to declare that off the table. No discussion whatsoever, and they've postponed it, they say, until the next leadership comes in the legislature. What did it look like there on the ground? Is this something that the Republicans felt that they can just push away until they have you know, is delay the best they can get come up with?
Yeah, you know, I think so. Look, most of these things, you know, the activity that we see that we're all part of, you know, in terms of getting our agenda items in a budget, let's say, you know, they're part of a much larger political game that goes on in Tallahassee, and so, you know, many projects, let's say water projects, those type of things, you know, the priority really is to spend more dollars in these areas to actually, you know, complete certain projects that help either clean water, conserve lands, perhaps restore, you know, ecosystems. And so, you know, this year I think, frankly, thanks to the Indian River area, which is in the backyard of Senator Negron, who happens to be the budget chair for the Senate, I think you saw a lot more attention because of that. I think, you know, his motivation, it goes back to all politics is local. And so, you know, what you saw were people clamoring for a resolution to a problem that isn't getting any better. And I think that combination resulted in better policy and in more attention being placed on areas that or in areas that really need attention. You know, Florida is broken in so many ways, not only in terms of the attention we put onto environmental issues, but everything from public education to healthcare, as you know. And again, you know, this last 60 days was, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of theater designed to improve the ability of certain people to get elected.
Well, let me. Interesting, you should say that because, of
sure.
course, the relatively speaking, it's business as usual. And for example, we see this bone being tossed to Thrasher. Does the Republicans
yeah.
in our legislature just assume that? Basically, the state education system is just a placeholder for retired politicians?
You know, it's interesting. I think some people look at it as that. You know, it's interesting. And look, there have been Democrats and Republicans that move into these jobs. I don't even know if it's a lateral type of move. It's usually an upgrade, frankly. You know,
I'm sure
I don't know what the president of FSU gets. Well, yeah, I mean, the president of FSU, I don't know what they get paid. It's certainly more than $29,000, which is basically, you know, what legislators are paid. But, you know, if you look at that type of situation, you know, and I believe Senator Thrasher, you know, is a graduate and is very close to FSU, and certainly that makes sense. But, you know, this is a public institution, and you know, I think you deserve in Florida to have the most elite intellectuals and you know, presidents of universities put into place, and you know, you would expect perhaps a much more vigorous, rigid process, you know, looking at candidates, and something that takes a long time to do. You don't see that necessarily in this situation. And, you know, there's been all kind of speculation surrounding, you know, this latest information about filling the vacancy. But, you know, I think it also, it kind of casts a pretty dark cloud over where we are as a state when we're kind of hand-picking, hand-choosing, cherry-picking, whatever you want to call it, people that are going to run universities.
Maybe we can find a slush fund and build them an airport or a lovely set of buildings.
The slush funds, sadly, for Floridians are generally, you know, trust funds.
Yeah.
Funds that, you know, the legislature sets up to pay for really important things, and then basically without any trust at all, they use those dollars to fund the general revenue and forget about the programs they were set up to, you know, actually fund. So I guess it's all how you look at, you know, how we handle money in the state as to how you define trust funds versus slush funds.
Yeah. Let me go to a more serious topic. You are Democratic policy chair, and I've been puzzled from time to time about some of the party's presence or lack of presence on legislative priorities. And you know, it seems to me that the Democratic Party has or at least what's visible anyway. It doesn't really seem to have a lot of energy to support our legislative efforts, and
right.
You know, we're in the middle of you know, what is theoretically the preparation for a primary, and the party seems to be sort of absent, at least visibly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As policy chair, you know, how do you see Democratic policy being shaped as we prepare for a gubernatorial election, another legislative session?
Right.
Give us your positive perspective, sir.
No. I could jump right in there. I mean, I think, you know, when you've gone 16 years, arguably, without a statewide state official, you know, what you find sometimes is a lack of a large following on a lot of different issues. And case in point, you know, the last statewide Democrat state official on the cabinet was Alex Sink. Alex was able to make decisions as the CFO, and her decisions basically weighed very, very heavily on policy and where individual legislators, both in the Senate and the House, would end up on a particular. And so what I mean by that is if you're on the floor and a particular bill comes up and, you know, you're wondering about the background, but the CFO's office provides an opinion on to the value or, you know, otherwise of a particular bill, you tend to look at that and you look at it seriously and you basically weigh what it's saying and how you're going to vote. And there were plenty of times when, you know, Alex Sink was CFO, that while you were on the floor, a memo would be issued on that CFO letterhead, and it would give you an indication as to, you know, what the motivation of a particular bill was, whether it be helpful, whether it be something that was harmful. We don't have that in the state of Florida. Basically, you know, we've got about, well, we have 45 people in the House from various regions of the state of Florida. You've got 14 from various regions in the Senate. And you have independent minds. And those independent minds come from far different places, sometimes on many issues. You know, I think what this tells you, it's not, you know, necessarily the party, actually, that has an influence on policy. It really, at this point, are the individual members that make up the legislature. If, you know, you look at the Republicans, they've got tremendous leadership. They basically have complete power and say so in the cabinet. You've got a governor. You have one senator, you know, U.S. senator, and you've got 16 years of appointments that have been made by various governors that basically are appointments that mimic ideology. And so it's very, very easy to understand why it looks like, you know, externally that the Republicans generally walk in one direction and Democrats generally walk in one direction, but on certain issues there is not a primary voice on those issues. And that's where I think you get a bit of fracturing when it comes to certain things that may look simple, you know, in terms of what your opinion is, whether you support something or not support something in Palm Beach County, let's say, as opposed to a Democrat from another area of the state of Florida that is really, very conservative in its ideology and how the districts are made up. And I think that really is an important component to, you know, understanding the situation we're in now.
Let me ask you this. I remember the lesson of LBJ, where as a legislative leader, he was able to cajole, coerce, or whatever you want to call it, his team into some really aggressive stances and really did some legislation that was remarkable in changing the country. And obviously, as a minority
yep.
party in the legislature, you don't have neither the resources nor the power, in large part,
right.
to do that sort of thing. But I was wondering if you could tell us: do the Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate get together for strategy sessions?
Yeah, well, I mean, we do and we don't. You know, there are laws that prohibit us as a group from sitting down quietly behind closed doors and doing things that are public business. And so,
well, on camera,
you know,
if need be.
Yeah. Say it again.
I was joking. I said, well, then on camera, if not, you know, doing public business behind the scenes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there are always discussions that occur that are outside of, you know, the site or the pickup of a microphone. But you know, as a caucus, you know, I can speak to, you know, the House side. We always conduct those type of public, you know, business decisions with the caucus, with cameras rolling and, you know, with press there. And you know, we generally do that in most instances. There are very few things that we've done over the years that I can recall where we've not done that way. And so, you know, when you talk about policy development, when we're in session, we meet every day we go onto the floor. We have a pre-caucus meeting where we openly discuss where we are on certain issues. We discuss, you know, some of the strategies involved on those issues. And, you know, we make decisions as a group where we can to be supportive of one another and decisions. And, you know, one of the decisions this year that we made early on as a group was combating and taking a position against the corporate voucher idea, which basically removes public education dollars, tax dollars, from the public education system and moves those towards private, you know, religious schools in many instances. And so we had a, you know, session-long position, caucus position, against that idea. So, you know, in those instances, we can do it. and, you know, the dynamics are different on every issue, but we do have those discussions. You know, if in fact we had a, you know, a governor that we could call our own, we'd have tremendous, you know, leverage over what we couldn't do, and we'd be able to involve ourselves in a lot more policy, you know, discussions that currently, because we do not have an edge anywhere in the state government in terms of cabinet members or other, we just don't have that ability to leverage a larger part of the discussion.
Let me ask you a question about a quote I found of yours back, goes back to March. And the comment was to the effect that democracy in action, the problem is the budget process, not the spending, House Democrat Pafford said. Could you elaborate a little bit? Obviously, there used to be more participation. Now there's not so much. Is that the idea?
Yeah, you know, many, many years ago, there was an ability for, you know, 120 members to have more say in the budget development. Currently, the way the system's set up, you know, let's say you and I are budget chairs for transportation and healthcare, as an example, you know, you're the healthcare guy, and you've got wait lists, you've got all kind of other issues with people, you know, living with disabilities, and I'm the guy out there who's building roads and planting trees along state roads, and you know, thinking about maybe putting new SunPass overhangs in. Crosswalks, potholes, bridges. Let's just assume that there is a need to wipe out those wait lists for those seniors that you're in charge of, you know, making their lives better. Unless an allocation is made by only the speaker, that's who makes the allocation, to provide those, you know, that ability to make those payments for those improvements in those seniors' lives, you are stuck with what you get. So let's say there's $10 that is given to you, and $20 is given to me for DOT projects. Once the allocation from the speaker's office occurs, you are not permitted as the healthcare chair to reach into my allocation, which might be healthcare. I'm sorry, which is transportation. I'm getting confused now. And you're not allowed to take a dollar to make somebody's life better. And those are the rules that are set up. Now, to compound that problem, allocations are made behind closed doors. There are very, very few people involved with that decision. There are discussions that go on between both chambers and the governor's office. And there are political motivations for making those allocations. And so those allocations are made usually 20 to 30 days into the 60-day session. So really there is no wiggle room, and nor is it really available to the average member to have a discussion about what I just talked about. The allocation at the end of the day is the allocation you are provided. And, you know, where I see this process as being more helpful, potentially, you know, we need to open up the process not only to these type of discussions in terms of where the real needs and priorities are way before 20 to 30 days in. You know, we need to be understanding where, in fact, we need to allocate dollars and be part of the speaker's decision. That's currently not the problem, and thus the process, which is what the quote said, is inevitably, at the end of the day, a major problem to developing policy that's good for all Floridians, not just a few.
Okay. Let me ask you this. The ongoing effort by the Republicans to siphon off public funds, whether it be to privatize prison guards or to take what seems to be not enough money for education and somehow squeeze off profit as well. How does that battle stand this year in this past session? Were they able to get their hands on more public funds, or was that effort held at bay for a while?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, from year to year, it's going to be about the same. I think any time you have members of the legislature who sign the loyalty oath supporting the Grover Norquist, you know, anti-tax type of language, then you're going to be continually from year to year constrained in terms of being able to raise more dollars for any particular need. You either get a larger allocation, which I discussed a few minutes ago, or you don't. And generally, you know, I would argue that, that as much as the state of Florida population is, has blossomed to upwards of 20 million, the size of the budget pie has remained relatively the same size. And so you're going to continue seeing smaller slices of pie to feed more people. When you have that type of situation in place, you have a very, very difficult time, you know, paying for prisons, paying for education, paying for health care, paying for environmental needs. And you're basically forcing yourself to find cheaper ways to perform the same duties and government services, which are basically services by the people for the people, and you begin looking outside to find it on the cheap. And so, you know, what you described in terms of prisons or corrections or you know, those type of issues, that's not going to change. This year there was no major expansion, but because the basic rules remain the same, you can expect, you know, it to come back in future years, unless we get, you know, a new governor.
I know that to primary or not to primary is a difficult question for many many Democrats, but if we were to imagine a hypothetical, do you think that public participation in the selection of candidates is in general a good thing, or so complicated and so demanding of resources that it should be avoided at all costs? Can I frame it?
Repeat the question one more time. I wanted to make sure I understood
it
fully.
Okay. I'm trying to do this delicately. And what
you can
getting at?
Rip the Band-Aid off. It's fine.
Okay. Then let me put it this way. There are Democrats who argue that a primary divides resources, spends resources unnecessary, and gives the opposition, I could say a loyal opposition, but I don't think so in the case of Republicans, to give
right.
the opposition too many potential grab points. And there, the other alternative to this point is that when you have a primary process, it gives the publics the opportunity to participate more in candidate selection. So do you put yourself more on the public participation side or more on the let's limit the damage and let's limit the expenditure of resources side of things?
Well, you know, to understand politics, one of the basic ideas is this, and especially, you know, when you're running against a Republican Party. Generally speaking, if you've got an opponent, they're going to come up with stuff one way or another, or they're going to make up stuff one way or another, and they're going to have tons of cash to basically get that message out there. You know, if you're a Democrat in the state of Florida, generally speaking, you're always behind in terms of fundraising, and you're always at a disadvantage. So it really, you know, doesn't matter in my mind one way. Well, it does matter one way or another. You know, they're going to come up with stuff anyway. That's just the name of the game. And, you know, if you're a Republican, you're going to generally have the resources to do that. And again, you know, this is 16 years of complete control and power. That's where dollars go. People don't want to invest in candidates that can't be part of a plurality to pass certain bills. And that's why that explains some of the problems we have. You know, in terms of, you know, primaries and debates and participation, I think it does help the process to get candidates in front of people talking about issues and, you know, having those debates. I don't see why you wouldn't do that. If anything, you're putting your name out there and you're demonstrating publicly that you're very credible and a viable candidate to be, you know, part of the office that you're seeking. So, you know, to me, it doesn't make sense.
Okay. That's a good answer, and I think very thoughtful. Let me ask you this. The three committees you're serving on, the Agricultural and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee, Appropriations Committee, and the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, seems to me that, you know, you've had as close a view to the Republican appropriations process as one can get.
As they permit.
Yeah, unless you're actually dealing the cards.
Right.
Could you just give kind of a glimpse of some of that?
Sure.
From what
every committee that I sit on has an appropriations, a budget function. You know, we'll start with the Agriculture and Natural Resource Appropriations Subcommittee. That committee meets and talks about water projects, Everglades restoration. It basically funds everything from protecting the Florida panther to cleaning up water. The budget process is something that limits the policy discussions in that particular committee. Generally, we're concerned with the dollar amounts that go to certain places within the budget, specifically the ag and natural resource, environmental type of things. We have a very good chair who is a Republican. His name is Ben Albritton, and, you know, I have a very good relationship with him. I believe, you know, his hands are tied most of the time in terms of dealing with the single allocation that's provided by the speaker. And, you know, right from the get-go, this committee is kind of strapped. We can't provide the dollars that are necessary to fund an overwhelming number of projects that are worthy of funding. The full appropriations committee is the House Appropriations Committee. It's considered to be pretty powerful. But again, you know, the underlying appropriations committees, like I just explained, for ag and natural resource appropriations, they are given an allocation. The chair gives provides a proposed budget, which is bumped up to this full appropriations committee. We have about 7 hours, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, to debate and ask questions and then take a vote in that committee, and then it goes to the full floor. There isn't a whole lot of time in any of those committees to really make much change. The way the process, going back to your process question and my quote, the way the process is set out and the rules that are in place, it forces people to go have private meetings with budget chairs behind closed doors, and that's never good for the public. But that's the reality. In terms of the Joint Legislative Budget Commission, that is a commission that meets generally every quarter, and it's made up of representatives and senators, and we basically take up issues that require changes usually in how dollars are spent or requests are made from agency heads to adjust things throughout the year so they can either spend more money, ask for more money, reallocate funds. And that's, in my view, a very dangerous commission because so much of their activity is not part of the normal budget process, which I just got done complaining about. You know, it helps fund things, but I don't believe that it's necessarily done in an open way. And I am pretty confident that suggestion I just made in terms of feeling about that process is shared not only by Democrats but also Republicans.
Let me ask you one last question, if I may.
Sure, I really appreciate
your time. You've been very generous. You know, the Corps of Engineers basically put a roadblock in front of this process about cleaning up the Everglades and rerouting it. And, you know, there's a thousand reasons why things can't be done. And it strikes me and many other people that it's kind of odd, since everyone's aware that this is the process we're trying to reroute some of that polluted water and get some of it flowing south. I'm wondering, you know, I've asked several people what they think the real underlying reason why they've decided to roadblock this this cleanup, and since there's been so much activity to try to get the damage that's being done to St. Lucie and to the Withlacoochee, to get that mitigated in some way, what do you think the underlying cause is for this roadblock? They're going to study it for a while, God knows how long.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously the Corps said they needed more time, but, you know, I think the underlying problem is this. When Rick Scott was elected, one of the first things he did was hack major portions of the South Florida Water Management District's budget. Employees were basically shown the door. The governor then went to South Florida Water Management, did a press conference and availability on the fact that he, you know, made South Florida Water Management a smaller agency. Basically what he did was, he neutered the agency and brought it to its knees. And so an agency responsible for cleanup and restoration and then preservation of the most unique water systems in the entire world was basically dismantled, and taking with that expertise that, you know, had been assembled over decades to perform a very important function, which is water availability and clean water, not only for 7 million people, but, you know, the Everglades. You fast forward 3.5 years, you've got projects that have not been completed, you've got projects that don't have budgets to be completed, and you've got a South Florida Water Management District that, you know, I have heard internally is a bit disorganized. And it's not saying anything about the people that are currently there, but, you know, when you're under budgeted, when you don't have the resources you need to make big decisions and thoroughly vet projects and ideas, and in this circumstance, you know, restoring the Everglades, you're not able to function as you would, and you are not able to provide detail to an agency like the Army Corps. I think it's disappointing because, you know, obviously I'm very much supportive getting that water moving south, and frankly, I think you know, Senator Negron would share that concern that this problem that's been created over 100 years now all of a sudden it's getting a lot of heat because of the you know, putrid discharges into the Indian River and out to the Caloosahatchee. This is not going to be a quick fix because we've wasted, in my opinion, 3.5 years. We could have had an opportunity to talk about, you know, swapping land and creating ways to move the water south, but we've not done that. And so, very long answer. You know, I think the true root and cause of this mess goes back 3.5 years when the governor interrupted what was working pretty well.
I see. If there's one comment you'd like to make to speak to Democrats, progressive Democrats across the state, as they prepare for what may be a primary season, what may be otherwise the election coming up in the fall, what advice would you give or what insight could you offer as these people prepare for this primary that will hopefully take place at the end of the summertime?
Sure. Well, you know, in terms of the primary, hopefully, you know, less damage is good. Certainly, I believe there will be a primary. Once we get past the primary, I would say never forget. You know, we've had 3.5 years of what I would consider probably the most harmful governor we've had since, you know, prior to Reconstruction. The governor has turned his back on Floridians that are taxpaying Floridians. He's turned his back on you know, everything that provides quality of life for people, and he's satisfied with that type of system that gives these largest corporations and the wealthiest Floridians far more than what we expect. When you're denying health care to six people a day who end up dying at the end of that day, when you're tearing apart water management districts, you know, these are prime examples of things that have occurred, including, you know, hacking away $1.3 billion of public education dollars and then trying to come back this year and saying it's historic funding when actually the truth is, you know, the per pupil spending levels are not historic at all. And so, you know, that's what we need to keep our eye on. you know, this is a critically important election. And going back to the beginning of our conversation where we talked about, you know, state leadership, we are desperate for a governor that will represent Floridians and taxpaying Floridians, us folk who are out there working every day who may not have the time to, you know, read the local newspaper or, you know, really engage. But we need to remind them, too, that, you know, the reason they're lives have not improved is because what we've had has been taken away. We've been devalued as a middle class, and we need to grab hold of that and take it back. And that's going to be critical in November.
Mark, can I ask you one more difficult question, sir, before
sure,
you leave?
Sure, sure.
Who is the Democratic Party of Florida going to run against our Republican senator?
Marco? Oh, God, who knows? I have no idea. You know,
May I suggest he continues to be me?
No. There's no place for me to go. And you know, as a lowly House member with a pretty big responsibility of, you know, guiding a 40-plus member caucus, I've got my hands full. I'm enjoying this role, and I've got blinders on to make sure that I can do that as well as I can do it. You know, in terms of political future, you never say never, but, you know, I've got two good senators, three actually from Palm Beach County that are young and lively, and they're not going anywhere. So I may be back in the ranks of unelected activist, and, you know, that satisfies me just as well. I'll be happy to do that, and maybe you'll create another seat in the studio for me, and I can start asking questions of people at
absolutely.
Some point.
Anytime,
yeah, there you
anytime.
Go.
Hey, thank you so
okay,
much
good,
for joining
good.
Us, and we really
hey,
appreciate
my
giving
pleasure.
Us a sample of your wisdom. Thanks again, Mark.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Florida Representative Mark Pafford giving us his insight on the 2014 legislative session. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Thanks for tuning in. If you don't support the show goes away. I'll tell you what, I'm not going to beg. I'm not going to plead. You hear too much of that. I'm not going to send you emails saying give us money. I'm just going to tell you, I want you to keep hearing this voice. Thanks again. Listen to more progressive activists. Thanks a lot for coming. Bye-bye.
Tell all the people that you see, follow me. Follow me. Tell all the people that your life's complete. Follow.